It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today, from curiosity to discovery. Like most kids, when James was a kid, he was curious. He'd go looking for tadpoles or salamanders or butterflies.
Anything that moved or flew or crawled or swam, and I could catch it, it wound up in my collection. And that included microbiological specimens as well. I got a microscope for Christmas one year, and I was out collecting pond water and, you know, creating slides and so on. You know, I was a complete science nerd. So actually, even as I'm saying it, I'm cringing.
Why are you cringing?
I'm not, because it just sounds like get a life, kid.
But when at a certain point, that kind of curiosity starts to disappear.
I'm sure there's data on this and studies on this, but obviously there's a very high degree of neuroplasticity in young minds, young brains that seems to decay on a curve. We all have dreams of flying, I think, when we're kids, and we tend to lose that as well. It's almost like the more we know about the world, the limits of what's possible start to crowd in on us.
And for some reason, that never really happened to James. And when he grew up, that sense of curiosity, it became a defining part of his professional work as a filmmaker.
Iceberg, right ahead!
His film, Titanic, became the second highest-grossing movie ever. And the highest-grossing film, he made that one, too.
You are not in Kansas anymore.
Avatar.
You are on Pandora, ladies and gentlemen. Respect that fact.
And his idea for Avatar actually came before Titanic. But at the time, and this was the early 1990s, James Cameron felt like the technology wasn't quite there yet to make it the way he wanted to make it, as he explained on the TED stage.
So I shelved it, and I made this other movie about a big ship that sinks. And... you know, I went in and pitched it to the studio as Romeo and Juliet on a ship. It's going to be this epic romance, passionate film. Secretly, what I wanted to do was I wanted to dive to the real wreck of Titanic, and that's why I made the movie. And that's the truth. Now, the studio didn't know that, but I convinced them. I said, we're going to dive to the wreck. We're going to film it for real. We'll be using it in the opening of the film. It'll be really important. It'll be a great marketing hook. And I talked them into funding an expedition.
Yeah, roger that. Okay, drop down and go into the first class gangway door. I want you guys working the D-deck reception area in the dining center.
So if you remember those opening scenes from Titanic, there's real footage of the shipwreck. And James Cameron filmed that footage himself. He went 2.5 miles below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay, now left. Now left.
Now, there was already tons of footage of the Titanic, and James Cameron could have used that in the movie, but he really wanted to see it himself.
I think, you know, I've said it jokingly, but I think there's a lot of truth to the idea that I probably made that movie because I believed I could actually dive to the Titanic. And if I could have actually dived to the Titanic without making the movie, I probably would have done that.
And so what started out as a curious impulse became the catalyst for discovery, to go to the deepest parts of the oceans, to film them, and then turn that footage into documentaries.
Every dive I've ever been on, I've seen something I haven't seen before. And on a few of those dives, I've seen things that nobody's seen before. I call it bearing witness, wanting to literally go and see it. Photographing it came later, but it was just, you know, wouldn't that be cool?
Today on the show, from curiosity to discovery, stories from dreamers, tinkerers, scientists, and yes, filmmakers, about the source of curiosity and how it drives the things they do. Later in the show, James Cameron returns with his journey from filmmaker to explorer and back. But first...
this is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
This is from the BBC adaptation of the series The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. And deep inside one of the chapters of one of the books in the series, there's a quote.
I guess it's not just the quote, it's the kind of situation, the quote. describes.
This is Thomas Thwaites.
I'm a designer.
And Thomas got kind of obsessed with this one quote a few years ago. It's at a point in the book where the main character, Arthur Dent...
This mundane, normal kind of, guy from South London, like me, finds himself alone on a kind of planet on the other side of the universe.
He had been extremely chastened to realize that although he originally came from a world which had cars and computers and ballet and Armagnac, he didn't by himself know how any of it worked. He couldn't do it. Left to his own devices, he couldn't build a toaster. He could just about make a sandwich, and that was it.
And when you read that quote, he couldn't build a toaster? That just stuck in your mind?
Yeah, and I just started thinking, God, it's just so mind-bogglingly complex. I mean, I don't know, I'm just looking around this studio, this BBC studio in London, yeah. And it's all kind of glass, steel, plastic, Oh, somebody's pointing at something. Don't fiddle with the... Oh, what?
Wood.
Huh?
Wood.
Wood.
Oh, wood!
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's...
There's wood.
Okay.
All right. There's wood in there, yeah.
There's one small piece of wood, but it's plywood. And so that's been sliced and then stuck together with some kind of complex glue. So basically, I don't think I could make anything in this studio.
Now, this was the realization Thomas had when he thought about that quote.
Left to his own devices, he couldn't build a toaster. He could just about make a sandwich, and that was it.
And if he had to, he realized he really couldn't make much of anything at all.
So that's when I thought, okay, I'm just going to try and make an electric toaster starting from scratch.
Here's Thomas Thwaites on the TED stage.
So I thought, okay, I'll try and make an electric toaster from scratch. And working on the idea that the cheapest electric toaster would also be the simplest to reverse engineer, I went and bought the cheapest toaster I could find, took it home, and was kind of dismayed to discover that inside this object, which I'd bought for just £3.94, there were 400 different bits made out of, 100 plus different materials. I didn't have the rest of my life to do this project. I had, maybe 9 months. So I thought, okay, I'll start with five. And these were steel, mica, plastic, copper, and nickel. So starting with steel, how do you make steel? So I went and knocked on the door of the Rio Tinto Chair of Advanced Mineral Extraction at the Royal School of Mines and said, how do you make steel? And Professor Silliers was very kind and talked me through it, and my vague rememberings from GCSE science, well, steel comes from iron. So I phoned up an iron mine and...
Okay.
Hello, can I speak to Jonathan, please?
He's underground at the moment.
Oh, he's underground. Oh. Well, I'm sort of embarking on a project. I'm trying to make a toaster, and I need to get some iron ore to make the steel bits inside the toaster.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if I could come down there and get some iron ore.
Yes, you can do.
Can I?
So Thomas traveled north to the mine, he went in, and he hacked away just enough iron to make steel. But he still needed...
copper, plastic, mica, which is this kind of heat and electrically resistant mineral, and nickel.
The amount of things Thomas discovered during the year he spent trying to make those things into a toaster is kind of mind-boggling. For instance, to get copper, he needed water from a mine.
Because water that kind of trickles through will kind of start becoming acidic, and that will lead to this kind of slightly acidic water leaching out the kind of minerals from the rock.
Once he distilled copper from that water, he went looking for the mineral mica, and he found it in the most remote place in Britain.
Mica in its natural form is this amazingly sort of beautiful, transparent rock, really. So it was kind of hacking it off the side of a mountain in Scotland.
Nickel turned out to be pretty easy. He just melted down some coins. But for plastic...
I realised that you can just about get to the Iron Age when you're kind of working alone. But in terms of making plastic from oil, there's no real way you can do that without a chemistry laboratory. So
he went to the local dump and he found some plastic to melt down into a mold. Now, that all took 9 months to hunt all this stuff down and assemble a toaster. And the final product looks, well, I guess you could sort of describe it as like a bunch of metal stick hanging out of like cake batter, like something drenched in cake batter.
Yeah, and it's got a kind of hole in the side. It's kind of half resembling a kind of Stone Age toaster, like a sort of Flintstones-esque toaster. It's sort of grotesque in some ways.
This is it's almost like you took this journey of discovery. Like you really did. You literally went to all these places to get this material.
Yeah, exactly. I came to this realization that, you know, everything is just so highly advanced. Even the most mundane sort of pen or pencil or, you know, like exercise book, you know, the staples in this cheap exercise book, they're made of this amazingly pure grade steel, certainly in comparison to the kind of metal I was able to make alone. But someone, you know, 200 years ago made a small incremental improvement to a process which, you know, is kind of long forgotten, really. But that has kind of contributed in some way to where we are today, really. It's like the whole history of humanity can be, you know, everyone who's ever lived can kind of be found in this, you know, mundane item, toasting bread.
Thomas Thwaites, you should really see his toaster and his talk at TED.com. By the way, he did plug it in once. Sparks flew, it overheated, and it burned out in about 5 seconds. But then it was sold to an art museum. What did they pay for it?
£20,000.
Wow. Yes. Did you get a cut of that?
I sure did. Yeah, it's bizarre.
I'm Guy Raz. Our show today, From Curiosity to Discovery. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on today's show, From Curiosity to Discovery, and how one often leads to the other. But sometimes discovery isn't really an endpoint. It's years of false starts that occasionally lead to a tiny breakthrough.
I guess I'm known as somewhat of a zebra hunter.
This is Wendy Chung. She's a genetic researcher and a pediatrician.
You know, when people hear hoofbeats, we say in medicine, you should usually think of horses rather than thinking of zebras. But many times families come to me after they've been to a lot of doctors for horses and haven't come up with answers, and so they think there may be something more unusual or more esoteric.
Wendy is actually more of a genetic detective, and the case she's been trying to crack for more than 20 years. Autism. Here's the opening from Wendy's TED Talk.
Why? Why is a question that parents ask me all the time. Why did my child develop autism? As a pediatrician, as a geneticist, as a researcher, we try and address that question. But autism is not a single condition. It's actually a spectrum of disorders. A spectrum that ranges, for instance, from Justin, a 13-year-old boy who's not verbal, who can't speak, who communicates by using an iPad to touch pictures to communicate his thoughts and his concerns. A little boy who, when he gets upset, will start rocking, and eventually, when he's disturbed enough, will bang his head to the point that he can actually cut it open and require stitches. That same diagnosis of autism, though, also applies to Gabriel, another 13-year-old boy who has quite a different set of challenges. He's actually quite remarkably gifted in mathematics. He can multiply three numbers by three numbers in his head with ease. Yet when it comes to trying to have a conversation, he has great difficulty. He doesn't make eye contact. He has difficulty starting a conversation, feels awkward. And when he gets nervous, he actually shuts down. Yet both of these boys have the same diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. One of the things that concerns us is whether or not there really is an epidemic of autism. These days, 1 in 88 children will be diagnosed with autism. And the question is, has that number been increasing dramatically over time? Or is it because we have now started labeling individuals with autism, simply giving them the diagnosis when they were still present there before? The next question everyone wonders is, what caused autism? In fact, there's probably not one single answer. Just as autism is a spectrum, there's a spectrum of etiologies, a spectrum of causes.
So the thing to know about Wendy Chung is that she never set out to crack autism. She was a genetics researcher who sort of stumbled upon a realization.
I think the realization came to me, or came to several of us, that genetics, at least, could be one of the factors in autism. It didn't necessarily mean that all children with autism had an underlying genetic cause, but that it could be the genetic cause.
And that theory was tested early in her career when she met a little girl named Nika.
In this particular case, Nika's parents came to me many, many years ago, having, you know, done the best they could to try and understand what was going on with their daughter and why she wasn't developing the same as other children.
For example, Nika couldn't speak. She clearly had significant disabilities, including autism.
But not any one thing that looked particularly unique. She looked like a beautiful, healthy child otherwise. But she clearly had something going on with her brain.
And on top of that, she'd get seizures, lots of them, on a daily basis.
She didn't have any family history of a similar condition, so there wasn't, you know, anything for us to think that it was something clearly running in the family.
And so Wendy Chung began to wonder, what if the source of Nika's disability was a genetic mutation, and what if you could identify that exact gene?
In certain individuals, they can actually have genetic changes or mutations that are not passed down from the mother or from the father, but actually start brand new in them. Mutations that are present in the egg or the sperm at the time of conception, but have not been passed down generation through generation within the family. So, in fact, at the Simons Foundation, we took 2,600 individuals that had no family history of autism, and we took that child and their mother and father and used them to try and understand what were those genes. To do that, we actually had to comprehensively be able to look at all that genetic information and determine what those differences were between the mother, the father, and the child. In doing so...
So as Wendy goes on to explain, every single human cell is made up of exactly 46 chromosomes. And if any one piece of those 46 chromosomes that make up the billions of cells in our bodies is out of balance, it can have a huge effect on the way our brains function. And so in the case of Nika, the girl who was diagnosed with autism as a toddler, Wendy was able to map out her genetic information to try and figure out what caused her brain to function in the way it did.
I still remember when we did that, the only reason we were able to find the cause, it was literally like looking for a needle in the haystack, was because we saw one single letter. Out of 3 billion alphabet letters, we saw one single letter for Nika that was different from her mom and different from her dad.
Wow.
Something we knew that wasn't inherited from either one of them. And suddenly when we looked at that particular place, that one letter that was different, we saw that it affected this gene called SNAP25,
wow,
essentially affecting all different areas for Nika's brain as well as causing her seizures.
You were able to discover that one single genetic mutation and identify it and know that that's where it came from.
That's exactly right. Knowing that this was the problem meant that we could start the journey to trying to figure out how to fix it.
But I mean, that journey, that process of trying to fix it could, I mean, that could take decades.
I think there are pieces of it we're cracking every day. In terms of understanding the complexities of the human mind, I don't know that we'll ever truly understand it.
Yeah, I mean, do you sort of think about what you do as trying to crack a code?
Oh, absolutely. So the first gene that we identified for a human disease took me 8 years. The last gene that we identified for a human disease took 8 days.
Wow.
It's really remarkable in terms of how quickly we can move forward. I think it's that puzzle that I'm so obsessed with is, at least from the genetic point of view, trying to crack that code about what those genes are, and trying to put that into a massive, you know, puzzle in terms of how those genes fit together, how those proteins fit together, how those neurons fit together, what the different parts of the brain do, and why they're different in some individuals.
Yeah, I mean, do you ever come home at night and just think, I may never figure this out, like, over the course of my career, it may never happen?
Well, I think, you know, the stark reality is, for many of us, we realize that there's only so much that we can do, and mysteries like this, really massively complex feats, you have to be able to break down in pieces.
Yeah.
But I think the humbling part of this is that the mind is just wonderfully, beautifully complex. And we will start to understand parts of it. So they're just amazing opportunities we have to study this like we didn't a generation ago.
Yeah.
But even still, we're wonderfully complex human beings, and appreciating all of that is awe-inspiring.
Wendy Chung is a genetic researcher and a pediatrician. You can find out more about her groundbreaking work and see her full talk at TED.com. So today on the show, we're talking about how curiosity leads to discovery. And Adam, you are up next. Can you introduce yourself?
All right. My name is Adam Savage. I'm currently co-host and executive producer of MythBusters on the Discovery Channel, and I'm a lifelong maker of things and curious person.
So, I mean, does curiosity, like, run in your family?
My dad was definitely a polymath. He was a painter, he was an animator, a filmmaker, a wonderful writer, but I'm trying to think if there was a moment I had. You know, he did make me a race car. I had this teddy bear named Gus, and I wanted a race car for it, and my dad spent weeks out in his studio making this thing out of hardware cloth, like wire mesh you'd make a hamster cage out of, and fiberglass, polyester fiberglass, which I still consider one of the worst materials to have to work with. And just the act of, I'm interested in a toy, I can make that toy. That's what he said to me by giving that to me. He didn't know how to do it. He was just winging it. And that was completely formative for me.
And like his dad, Adam's a maker. He's designed models and props for big films. But you may know him best from the TV show MythBusters, where he and his co-host Jamie Hyneman test out questions like, if you drop a penny off the Empire State Building, would it kill someone?
We realized that the strongest episodes were the ones driven by the narrative of our curiosity. You know, that is the nature of science. It's often that you know, the discovery is not the end of a line of looking for something. It's tangential to it because something happens you didn't expect. Someone said that the phrase that typifies real discovery isn't eureka, but, huh, that's funny.
Okay, go ahead, Adam.
Has there been an episode where, like, the outcome was not at all what you expected?
Yeah, there's a really good example. There's a myth about a guy who got very drunk at a party and convinced a friend of his to drive him home.
Break hard left.
Except the problem was his friend was legally blind.
Huh.
But they got home because he gave his blind friend directions from the back seat.
Yeah.
So Jamie and I actually got a real blind guy.
Jerry's 100% blind, and that means...
We put him in the front seat of a car while we sat in the back on a closed course, of course.
Start to brake. Now turn hard left. Perfect.
But to really tell the story, we needed to have a drunk person. So Jamie got drunk.
Floor it.
Yes.
He knows better than to listen to me.
And the most astonishing thing happened that we did not expect at all was that Jamie's directions...
Straight now. Right.
Immediately made the blind guy drive like a drunk person.
Wow.
I swear he is weaving a lot more around the road. It's like...
Behind the car, it was totally clear that there was a drunk person in charge of the car. It's one of my all-time favorite results.
Okay, so nobody exactly won a prize for that experiment. But the point is, Adam checked out a weird idea, and he discovered something kind of interesting. And nobody got hurt. Here's Adam on the TED stage.
One of the funny things about owning a brain is that you have no control over the things that it gathers and holds on to, the facts and the stories. And as you get older, it only gets worse. Things stick around for years sometimes before you understand why you're interested in them, before you understand their import to you. When Richard Feynman was a young boy in Queens, he went for a walk with his dad and his wagon and a ball. And he noticed that when he pulled the wagon, the ball went to the back of the wagon. And he asked his dad, why does the ball go to the back of the wagon? And his dad said, that's inertia. He said, what's inertia? And his dad said, ah, inertia is the name that scientists give to the phenomenon of the ball going to the back of the wagon. But in truth, nobody really knows. Feynman went on to earn degrees at MIT, Princeton. He solved the Challenger disaster, and he ended up winning the Nobel Prize in Physics for his Feynman diagrams describing the movement of subatomic particles. And he credits that conversation with his father as giving him a sense that the simplest questions could carry you out to the edge of human knowledge, and that that's where he wanted to play. And play he did.
I mean, I think about this story, and you think, like, if Feynman wasn't that kid, if he didn't have that sense of curiosity, could he have gone on to do what he did? Like, it's almost like he had to ask those questions. He had to be that kind of person.
Yeah. I mean, he had the brain. He had the brain that totally wanted to exercise itself. There's another story about Feynman of him cooking a spaghetti dinner with a friend. And his friend, as he's breaking the spaghetti to put it in the pot, he notices that the strands of dry spaghetti don't just break cleanly in half, that there's often a third piece that springs out between the other two.
Yeah.
And from a material science standpoint, that is a strange behavior. And as the story goes, they never got to eating. They ended up breaking every piece of pasta they could find in the house to try and figure out why the molecular structure of pasta led it to do this weird thing where it broke a third piece off. This is what really gets me going about science. Whenever I'm having trouble understanding a concept, I go back and I research the people that discovered that concept. I look at the story of how they came to understand it. And what happens when you look at what the discoverers were thinking about when they made their discoveries is you understand that they are not so different from us. We are all bags of meat and water. We all start with the same tools. I love the idea that different branches of science are called fields of study. Most people think of science as a closed black box, and in fact, it is an open field.
Do you like see the process of discovery as almost like a journey rather than a place that you need to get to figure it out?
Oh, that's 110%. That there is no end. There is no point at which you think, well, I'm done. There is the chasing the moment of interest and turning it into a moment of understanding, however small.
I mean, I guess I'm always amazed, like, when you talk to a child, right? They're full of questions about just the universe, about everything around them, about why cars move and how they move and how a telephone works.
Right.
And all these questions that at a certain point in our lives, they're not answered. But we just accept that they're unanswered questions and we move on. But, like, that's sort of a sad defeat on the part of us adults, don't you think?
Yes. And I was very lucky that in high school I had two science teachers that were really influential on me. One was my freshman earth science teacher who he would say things in class that would rock my world. And I was a lonely kid. I didn't have much to do at lunch. So I would go back to his classroom, which was right across the hall from the lunchroom. And I would sit there and just ask him questions. And this is, I like to say, this is so long ago. He was sitting there in an off period grading papers and smoking in the classroom. But he would sit and answer questions. And then, you know, any line of questioning leads to the ultimate, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because we don't know the most fundamental parts of everything.
Or sometimes when you do have the answer and your five-year-old says, that's not true, you just say, well, if you don't think it's true, stop asking me.
Yeah, and this teacher would sit there, and when I got to the end of a line of questioning, he'd say, I have no idea. I don't know why a candle flame goes pop when you flick it with your finger.
Yeah.
And for a teacher to say that to a kid is really important. It's actually critical for kids to learn that the people in authority don't know everything. In fact, really don't know anything.
We are all explorers. The people that made discoveries just thought a little bit harder about what they were looking at, and they were a little bit more curious. And their curiosity changed the way people thought about the world, and thus it changed the world. They changed the world, and so can you. Thank you.
Adam Savage is the co-host of the show MythBusters. Check out his two talks at ted.npr.org. Oh, and in case you were wondering, what does happen if you drop a penny off the Empire State Building?
3, 2, 1.
Ow! That didn't actually hurt that much.
Our show today, From Curiosity to Discovery, How It Begins, How We Keep It Alive in Ourselves. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, From Curiosity to Discovery, stories about the source of curiosity and how it drives the things we do. So what drives your curiosity?
I think for me, what I became just, you know, addicted to early on was finding new things. And it's sort of, in a very sort of basic way, it's a little bit like you're pinging nature. You know, science is this amazing thing where you can basically ask questions of nature and nature will provide some sort of answer to you. And there's something so incredible about being able to do that.
This is Nathan Wolfe. He's a microbiologist and something of an explorer.
The reality is there's so much unexplored that's all around us if we think about life in a slightly different way.
And he says to make those new discoveries, we don't have to look too far. Here's Nathan Wolfe on the TED stage.
Recently, I visited Beloit, Wisconsin, and I was there to honor a great 20th century explorer, Roy Chapman Andrews. During his time at the American Museum of Natural History, Andrews led a range of expeditions to uncharted regions, like here in the Gobi Desert. He was quite a figure. He was later, it said, the basis of the Indiana Jones character. And when I was in Beloit, Wisconsin, I gave a public lecture to a group of middle school students. And I'm here to tell you, if there's anything more intimidating than talking here at TED, it'll be trying to hold the attention of a group of 1,000 12-year-olds for a 45-minute lecture. Don't try that one. At the end of the lecture, they asked a number of questions, but there was one that's really stuck with me since then. There was a young girl who stood up, and she asked the question, where should we explore? I think there's a sense that many of us have that the great age of exploration on Earth is over, that for the next generation, they're going to have to go to outer space or the deepest oceans in order to find something significant to explore. But is that really the case? Is there really nowhere significant for us to explore left here on Earth?
Nathan says, of course there is. And the next frontier, microbes. Now, it sounds a little strange, I know, but there's actually so little we know about microbes, even the ones in our very own bodies.
If you really just were to think about the diversity of microbes that are on your hand or on the outside of your coffee cup, there's likely to be unexplored, unknown diversity just sitting right there in that environment. And so I think one of the things that excites me as a scientist about that world is sort of how much is left to discover.
You can experience like 6 billion moon landings every day just on a coffee cup.
That's exactly right, yes. We now know that viruses make up the majority of the genetic information on our planet, more than the genetic information in all other forms of life combined. And obviously, there's been tremendous practical applications associated with this world, things like the eradication of smallpox, the advent of a vaccine against cervical cancer, which we now know is mostly caused by human papillomavirus. We now have these amazing tools to allow us to explore the unseen world. Things like deep sequencing, which allow us to do much more than just sort of skim the surface and look at individual genomes from a particular species, but to look at entire metagenomes. the communities of teeming microorganisms in, on, and around us, and to document all of the genetic information in these species. We can apply these techniques to things from soil to skin and everything in between.
We're just at the very beginning of understanding this whole new world of microbes.
Absolutely. This is one of the most exciting things about being a microbiologist right now, is that the tools that we have for exploration sort of are sort of the equivalent of telescopes and GPS systems that we have for navigating this unseen world have exploded really even over the last 5 to 10 years. We could take a specimen, like let's say we were to take a swab from your nose, for example.
The first thing that we would see is a tremendous amount of genetic information. And if we started looking into that genetic information, we'd see a number of usual suspects out there. Of course, a lot of human genetic information, but also bacterial and viral information, mostly from things that are completely harmless within your nose. But we'd also see something very, very surprising. As we started to look at this information, we would see that about 20% of the genetic information in your nose doesn't match anything that we've ever seen before. No plant, animal, fungus, virus, or bacteria. Basically, we have no clue what this is. And for the small group of us who actually study this kind of data, a few of us have actually begun to call this information biological dark matter. We know it's not anything that we've seen before. It's sort of the equivalent of an uncharted continent right within our own genetic information. And there's a lot of it. If you think 20% of genetic information in your nose is a lot of biological dark matter, if we looked at your gut, up to 40 or 50% of that information is biological dark matter. And even in the relatively sterile blood, around 1 to 2% of this information is dark matter. Can't be classified, can't be typed or matched with anything that we've seen before.
All right, so let me make sure I have this right. I mean, you're saying that within our own DNA, there are these tiny bits of genetic information that no scientist has ever been able to identify. Like, they don't know what it is, and that's crazy.
Yes, and you know, people think about the data revolution. Everyone's very interested in how much data is out there and how much data does Facebook have, and it seems like a tremendous amount. Well, I'll tell you right now that most of the information content of our planet is locked up in microbes and the DNA and RNA of microorganisms, and we're only just starting to sort of uncover what that means.
At first, we thought that perhaps this was artifact, right? These deep sequencing tools are relatively new, but as they've become more and more accurate, we've determined that this information is a form of life, or at least some of it is a form of life. And while the hypotheses for explaining the existence of biological dark matter are really only in their infancy, there's a very, very exciting possibility that exists. That buried in this life are signatures, and this genetic information are signatures of as of yet unidentified life, that perhaps will allow us to identify the cause of a cancer that afflicts us, or identify the source of an outbreak that we aren't familiar with, or perhaps create a new tool in molecular biology. A little over 100 years ago, people were unaware of viruses, the forms of life that make up most of the genetic information on our planet. 100 years from now, people may marvel that we were perhaps completely unaware of a new class of life that literally was right under our noses. There was a time not very long ago when the discovery of unknown organisms was something that held incredible awe for us. It had potential to really change the way that we saw ourselves and thought about ourselves. Many people, I think, on our planet right now despair, and they think we've reached a point where we've discovered most of the things. I'm going to tell you right now, please don't despair. This is honestly the most exciting period ever for the study of unknown life forms on our planet. The dominant things that exist here, we know almost nothing about. And yet, finally, we have the tools which will allow us to actually explore that world and understand them. Thank you very much.
Nathan Wolf, he's a microbiologist who also looks for the source of viruses. His amazing TED Talk is at ted.npr.org.
Snoop Dogg's on the move. We're headed down the stairwell.
earlier in the show, we heard from James Cameron, who gave a TED Talk all about curiosity. And he explained how, in the opening scenes of his film Titanic, he used small robots to explore the ship's wreckage.
We're good. Just chill, boss.
Those robots were hunting for treasure. But for James Cameron, the footage he was shooting was the real treasure. He filmed it himself, 2.5 miles below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean.
And, you know, it took a lot of preparation. We had to build cameras and lights and all kinds of things. But it struck me how much this dive, these deep dives, was like a space mission, you know, where it was highly technical, and it required enormous planning. And you get in this capsule, you go down to this dark, hostile environment where there's no hope of rescue if you can't get back by yourself. And, you know, I've thought, wow, I'm like living in a science fiction movie. This is really cool. And so I really got bitten by the bug of deep ocean exploration. Of course, the curiosity, the science component of it, it was everything. It was adventure, it was curiosity, it was imagination, and it was an experience that Hollywood couldn't give me. Because, you know, I could imagine a creature and we could create a visual effect for it, but I couldn't imagine what I was seeing out that window. As we did some of our subsequent expeditions, I was seeing creatures at hydrothermal vents and sometimes things that I had never seen before, sometimes things that no one had seen before that actually were not described by science at the time that we saw them and imaged them. So I was completely smitten by this and had to do more. And so I actually made a kind of curious decision. After the success of Titanic, I said, okay, you know, I'm going to park my day job as a Hollywood movie maker, and I'm going to go be a full-time explorer for a while.
A while has now been almost 2 decades, and during that time, James Cameron has made more than a dozen deep-sea dives, and he's produced 7 documentaries about some of the deepest underwater spots in the world. He recently released an 8th, which was shot during his deepest dive ever.
Surface, deep sea Challenger.
In 2012, James and a team of scientists launched a custom-designed craft to the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Deep sea Challenger, copy. Understood.
And in that trench, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, is the deepest spot in all the world's oceans. It's called Challenger Deep. And in homage to that spot, James Cameron named his underwater craft the Deep Sea Challenger.
1-8.
I remember on that dive, I got through my entire checklist like an astronaut, and I was doing all my check-ins and my navigation and all that. I got down to 27,000 feet, and I realized that I had just passed a threshold. It was deeper than the deepest prior dive I'd done on the expedition, which was 5 miles deep, which we did in the New Britain Trench a couple weeks earlier. I was deeper than the other deepest diving manned submersible on the planet could go. I was in a territory where there was no potential hope of rescue from any other existing technology. So for the first time, I was thinking about, that's a lot of water over my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think at a certain point in the film, you say that if you put Mount Everest at the bottom of the ocean and then stack 4 Empire State Buildings on top of it, you still wouldn't break the surface of the ocean.
Yeah, which gives you a sense of how deep it is. Another way to visualize it is the next time you're in a commercial airliner at cruise altitude at 36,000 feet, look down, and that's how far the bottom of the ocean would be under you if you were in a ship at Challenger Deep.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's you're a tiny speck.
Surface, this is Deep Sea Challenger. I am on the bottom.
Depth is 35,756
feet. And
of course I blew it. You know, I mean, I didn't have anything brilliant to say. I hadn't thought. So what I did was I called in. I said I'm on the bottom.
56 feet.
I called in the depth.
And life support's good.
Everything looks good.
Oh, my God.
And I kind of mutter to myself, well...
Whatever I thought I was going to say at that moment wasn't going to be that.
How different was what you expected to see at the bottom to what you actually did see at the bottom?
I think that I was surprised that there was so little visible life, because even at 5 miles depth in the New Britain Trench, there were still worm tracks and small invertebrate tracks all over the ground. And so I thought, okay, extrapolating from that, there should be quite a bit down there. And what I found was
flat and featureless. I didn't even see any animal tracks.
Almost featureless bottom that looked like new fallen snow.
Unbelievable. Like the moon.
So you spent 3 hours on the ocean floor, the deepest spot in the world. You've seen life that nobody has ever seen before. And you've been to the Titanic, what, twice?
We did three expeditions to Titanic in total, two of which were internal surveys where we went in with ROVs and explored around inside the wreck. And I've estimated that I've spent more time on the deck of Titanic than the captain of Titanic did. Because the ship sank only a few days into its lifespan.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it seems like you become curious about something, but you never – it's not like a journey to an endpoint. It's not like, okay, I'm going to find out everything about it, and then I'm going to move on.
I eventually did move on. You know, I mean, I think after the third expedition, I felt like even though there was more that could be found, that I had spent enough time to satisfy myself there. And I was happy to pass the baton to anybody that wanted to come along afterwards. But I'm a curious monkey. I mean, we all are to some extent. It's one of our great gifts as primates that we want to pick things up and turn them over and see how they work and put them together and build tools. And, you know, science is curiosity acted upon. People going and investigating. Then one thing leads to another, and pretty soon you've got a spacefaring civilization.
So what can we synthesize out of all this? You know, what are the lessons learned? Well, I think number one is curiosity. It's the most powerful thing you own. Imagination is a force that can actually manifest a reality. And the respect of your team is more important than all the laurels in the world. I have young filmmakers come up to me and say, you know, give me some advice for doing this. And I say, don't put limitations on yourself. Other people will do that for you. Don't do it to yourself. Don't bet against yourself. And take risks. NASA has this phrase that they like, failure is not an option. But failure has to be an option in art and in exploration because it's a leap of faith. And no important endeavor that required innovation was done without risk. You have to be willing to take those risks. Whatever you're doing, failure is an option, but fear is not. Thank you.
James Cameron, his film about diving to Challenger Deep is Deep Sea Challenge 3D. He's taking a break from the ocean for a while. He's working on 3 Avatar movies set to be released on 3 consecutive Christmases starting in 2016. You can see his entire talk at ted.npr.org.
If I climb a tree just to see what I see, does that make me curious? If I make a point of just cruising a joint, would that make me curious? And if it's profoundness, just looking around, well then gee whiz. Don't call me crazy, I've never been lazy, curious it is.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week, from Curiosity to Discovery. If you missed any of it or you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Curious like me.